Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good evening, Radio Land, and welcome to Endeavors on CGSF 90.1 FM. Simon Fraser University, Burnaby Mountain, beautiful day, only 1 month officially to the start of summer, but I say summer is already here. We're also on the web, of course, at cgsf.ca. We stream, we podcast, we're on SoundCloud, we do it all. And of course, you can listen to us on TELUS HD channel 7014. On today's show, comedian and actor Greg Proops took time out of his busy book tour to talk on the phone with me about his new book, The Smartest Book in the World, as a companion to his podcast, The Smartest Man in the World. And of course, I talked baseball with him because I never miss a chance to talk baseball with anybody. You'll also hear from Major Domo, butler, and etiquette expert Charles McPherson. Did you know that there are 7 kinds of plates and that a red wine glass is bigger than a white wine glass? And our musical feature today is brooding Irishman James Vincent McMorrow. This show goes out to Uber Greg Proops fan, Uber Irish fan, Celticophile, is that the correct term? My old high school classmate, my birthday twin. She's at home in Victoria. Alyssa Skinner. Hello, Alyssa. Hope you're tuning in. Thanks for being a fan and reader of my blog. And hello from Vancouver. Well, you know my first guest mostly from his work on the improvisational comedy show Whose Line Is It Anyway? First with host Clive Anderson in Britain. Then when it moved to the States with Drew Carey, and more recently with hostess Aisha Tyler. He's also taken part in improv on Drew Carey's Improvaganza. He's also appeared on Straight Comedy, the sitcom, most notably in True Jackson VP, where he stars as Max Madigan, and more recently Easy to Assemble, where he played Ben opposite Elena Douglas. He's also been a voice actor, and he was the voice for many years of Bob the Builder on the TV series of the same name, and he was the voice of Fod, the pod race announcer in Star Wars Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. His podcast is a thing of beauty. It is The Smartest Man in the World, where he talks about everything from his love of baseball to his left-wing politics to his feminism. And to go with it, he just released a book called The Smartest Book in the World, which is a list of some of his favorite things: the all-women baseball team, the all-Negro League baseball team, the all-dictator baseball team, that's a personal favorite of mine, the all-baseball baseball team, as well as his favorite things of poetry, music, and film. He is, of course, Greg Proops. And I spoke to him earlier today from Portland, where he was on his book tour. This is Greg Proops. Greg Proops, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure, Ben.
How did you acquire your vast wealth of knowledge?
Oh, you know, just hanging around on the road, reading, studying. I never graduated college, so my advice is, of course, don't stay in school. I think you can educate yourself, and you know, I get around the world. We've been around town with us to last year: Holland, Finland, Stockholm, Paris, Amsterdam, Scotland. I pick up stuff here and there.
Are you going to come and do a show in Canada anytime soon?
Sadly, no. Only because of time constraints. I'm on tour right now. We're doing the West Coast, and then I have to go to England, and we're going to do Whose Line on the West End with Aubrey and Clive Anderson and Jesse Lawrence. We're doing that in June.
How is it going to be doing a live Hoogeline show on the West End with a lot of the original British cast?
Well, it's going to be awesome. I can't wait to do it. I'm really looking forward. I did a last Edinburgh last August. Josie and Colin and I did a couple weeks on the Fringe doing the live show there. That went so well that the producers of Hoogeline were like, "Let's do it." So that's why it happened, I think.
Hoogeline is in its third incarnation now. How do you find that comedy has changed, and television comedy has changed since you first started Hoogeline?
Oh, well, television comedy is almost irrelevant. I mean, anybody who's under a certain age bother with TV anymore. I think it's all about the interweb and the smartphone. That I certainly see the future. I do a lot of, do the podcast and everything. That's where I think comedy fans go. Yeah. They can have their comedy on demand, and it's very personal and intimate, and there's a lack of, I don't have to take a meeting, I don't have to have a sponsor, anything. My wife and I do this, because that immediacy has changed televisions. And I think televisions had to grow up really fast as far as, like, they're letting women star in shows more that are, the writer types like Amy Schumer and, Amy Poehler and Mindy Kaling. And I think that's the best thing that's happened. More women comedy stars.
It seems like everybody and their dog is now doing a podcast. What do you like about it? Does it give you a certain amount of freedom that may not be found in other mediums?
Absolutely. And it's from the heart, like it's one-on-one, like we're talking now. I think you really connect with the people that listen to the show because it's so immediate. There's no distance. It's like a phone call. I have an intimacy with the podcast crowd that I never thought I could have with any fantastic. I talk about books and vodka and poetry and cover on my show, and people come to the show and they draw pictures, they write poems, they give me books. So it's a real exchange, which I would have never gotten from television.
In terms of the different styles of comedy that you have done over the years, stand-up, improv, the traditional sitcom, does your approach to the material change depending on what type of comedy you're doing?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, with the with a sitcom, you've got to learn your lines and hit your mic, and you're more of a giant undertaking. And with the improv, you're in a team, so I can't just step out and start giving my poison opinion. With the podcast, I can just do what I want and freestyle. So it's a little bit different with everything. In stand-up, of course, you want to write material and get your message, execute it the way you want it to be said and everything. So there's a little more precision with that. But I like to freestyle all those things. I like to bring an element of danger to it. I think big stakes, that would be the approach I try to take with everything, is go big or go home.
I would be remiss if I didn't get a chance to talk baseball with you. I am a Canadian, but unlike most of my countrymen, I'm a baseball freak and don't care for hockey.
That makes you singular among Canadians.
Yeah. Satchel Paige, you talk a lot about. I remember I first read about him, I guess, when I was 9 or 10, possibly even younger. And you've stated on numerous occasions that he is your hero in many ways. What is it about Satchel Paige that speaks to you?
I think he had to overcome enormous odds in his life. Poverty and racism, exclusion, segregation, hatred, vitriol. And he did it with humor and grace and aplomb. He was a great athlete, and I think he was an astounding, remember, and in the segregated days, he was probably the most famous black sports world, definitely in North America, and was making have made if he was in the majors, and he did that all on his own. He thought it up, and he did it. He realized how popular he was, and he went with it, and I think that's just an astounding accomplishment, considering the bulk of his career, over 60, 70 years ago.
Yeah, and he didn't even hit the majors until he was 42.
Yeah, right? It was not old. I love not ever telling the truth about yourself.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And yet you also stated in the same book that Willie Mays is your favorite player.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw Willie Little, and he was, he was older then, but he was the most charismatic player and absolutely thrilling to see on the pitch. I mean, like, he could really run the ball down, and the way he ran around the bases with his arms windmilling, and he'd look over and right and everything. I just think he did everything for baseball. First of all, he was a genius. He'd take pitches early in the game, knowing that the pitcher would throw them with the game on the line, and he'd wait the pitcher out, and then he'd get the pitch that he was after, and he'd catch. And I don't think anyone sat down and taught him to do that either. I think he picked it up as he went. He was an acute baseball mind, and he was delightful, and he still is delightful. I think grown men weep, when they think about figures like him. Not that there's not lots of great players now. I think we're living in a boom time for great players. I mean, when you look at Trout and Buster Posey and all the fat pitchers and everything, Strasburg and whatnot there, it's just, this is a very good time for baseball. There aren't, fat dudes chewing tobacco anymore.
Who do you like this year for this series? Are your Giants going to take it? I mean, you guys have Mad Bloom, but do you have any predictions, or is it too early to make that call for you?
Oh, no, I could never predict. I mean, here I booked an entire month of work right over, and of course the Giants went. So I had to watch it. I watched the playoffs and the World Series from about 5 million different places, Seattle, London, Antwerp. Put my phone on and the phone would light up, and then I knew we'd won. I was watching games at 4 in the morning in Europe, and then the last game we listened to on the radio in Hawaii, so I was all over the out month. So I'm terrible at predicting.
All right, a couple of rapid-fire questions. Instant replay, yay or nay?
Oh, no, nay.
I tend to agree with you, especially as of late. I think it's caused more headaches than good. Bonds and Clemens, should they be in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
But what about the other people that have allegedly used PEDs, like Mark McGuire, Sammy Sosa?
World Hip Hop owners. I don't know who the writers are protecting from this, but everybody loved when McGuire's. They weren't doing anything illegal within the context of the legality of the game. Just wanted them to do it. The owners were happy to take the money. I think the owners can go copulate with themselves.
Well, I think I heard I think I heard it was Stephen Smith that said, look, I mean, you have people like Wagner and Cobb who played in the dead ball era, and that was that, and then you have people like Bonds and Clemens play in this era, and their accomplishments shouldn't be negated just because they played in the so-called steroid era.
Oh, no. I mean, look, Cobb and Wagner against black people. They didn't have to fly on planes. They didn't play night games. They didn't play against Cleavers. So it's all in context,
Yeah.
And the players in the drank like fish, and the players in the 60s took amphetamine constantly, and in the 80s players were coked up, so it's always something. I think the moralizing is really awful, and I think if the owners want to help, instead of putting clocks on the field and instant replay, they should make the parking $5, make the admission $10, so you could go with your family. And I'm very serious when I say that. I know it's nice. If they want everybody to love baseball again, they should lower the bloody prices.
Do you think there's been a lot of talk about the decline of the quality of umpiring? Do you think there needs to be more accountability in that area?
Well, they could have women umpiring. I mean, let's get it going. How long are we going to wait on this? I think decline is because they broke the union a few years ago, and the union made that awful decision, and then they got rid of a bunch of them. Yeah, I don't know. I don't umpires are the problem. For me, the problem is the owners, the problem, everything. They think they can tinker with the game, and the game doesn't need tinkering. It took them forever to get Japanese players to play, and great they are. It took them forever to get Koreans in the game. It took forever to have Anderson manage. There's no minority owners except maybe Magic Johnson. Just ridiculous.
Yeah.
What an enclosed white billionaire world owners live in. And therefore, I think they're completely out of touch with what people like about baseball. And they're, oh, you know, all the fans are old and white. Yeah, well, why do you think that is? Because you're not offering anybody outside of old white guys anything to get excited about.
Speaking of accomplishments, you're probably the only guy that I could ask this to, but Harvey Haddix, probably the greatest performance in the history of baseball. Should it be included with the list of perfect games?
I think it should. I was mad when they took it away from him. There was a bunch of no-hitters like that, you know. There was also a perfect game by Ernie Shore that Babe Ruth started on the Red Sox. And Shore went in and picked the guy off first and then put down 26, and they took that away from Shore as well. I don't understand some of the statistics, how they, after the fact, that people, you know. I understand when they find games and stuff. Like, I think, was it Mathewson went from 372 to 373, and they added a few hits to Cobb a few years ago, but no one wants them to tinker with the numbers. The numbers seem immutable.
Yeah.
Haddix pitched a beautiful perfect game, and they should be given credit for, or at least the nine-inning part. Put an asterisk next to it.
Yeah, kind of like Galarraga or Pedro.
Right? Yeah. It's also sanctimonious, this, oh, this wasn't a perfect game, and this was this and that, and I don't know. I think people watch because they like the players, you know.
Oh, for sure, for sure. So, who out of the cast of Whose Line and Improvaganza, who would you fuck? Who would you marry? Who would you kill?
Well, I have had sex with me, and I am just symbolically married to them. So, all of me to kill them all so that they get out of my way.
Great answer. I like that. Okay. You've worked with three different hosts, Drew, Clive, and Aisha. What do you have to say about their styles of hosting?
Well, Clive is the world right man, and it's all true. He has no neck. Drew, I never understood a word Drew said because his diction was faulty. And is absolutely lovely.
Yeah.
She's funny. She's game. She runs downstairs, and she can really do it all.
Do you have a favorite moment from Whose Line? I know one that really sticks out for me was, I think it was about season 2 or 3 of Drew's version, when he called Africa a country.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
And then he made you be a male stripper during the closing credits.
I like that one. He said it was a country, I believe.
And finally, you've got so much trivia ingrained in this book. Two more questions. One is, could you beat Ken Jennings from Jeopardy in a trivia contest?
Oh, I don't know. He's pretty bright, that Ken Jennings. But I'd take him on. If you can arrange it, I'll do it.
Alrighty, I'll get on that. And finally, if you could meet anybody from history and have dinner with them for one night, who would it be?
If you could, quick, because you're narrowing it down so much. What is it we're going to do?
Oh. Well, let's see.
Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton? Okay. Do you think she'll be the next president?
I think she will be.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad Bernie's in the race, because I think the U.S. needs a significant nudge over to the left.
Couldn't be healthier. I mean, look at where the Democrats are coming from with Clinton and Sanders, and look at the other teams. It's all witchcraft and, you know, magical spells.
Rubio, Cruz, Carson, and Bush. I mean, that's enough to make, you know, anybody move up here.
Horrible, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I love the book, the smartest book in the world, and your podcast.
I really appreciate
The Smartest Man in the World. Greg Proops, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with your Canadian fans today.
Thank you, young brother.
Alrighty, have a good one. Take care. Ciao. Just before the break there, you heard my interview with actor and comedian Greg Proops. Once again, the title of his book is The Smartest Book in the World, A Lexicon of Literacy, A Rancorous Reportage, A Concise Curriculum of Cool. Be sure to check Greg's podcast out, The Smartest Man in the World. I promise you, it is a rocking good time. So, of course, Greg and I were discussing baseball, as you heard. And one of the players that came up was Harvey Haddix, who famously threw 12 perfect innings, 36 hit, 36 down, before losing it in the 19th. And so in honor of Greg and our love of baseball, we are now going to play a song by a supergroup called the Baseball Project, which was co-founded by the legendary Steve Wynn. They have a song appropriately called Harvey Haddix, and so we will give that to you now. This is the Baseball Project with Harvey Haddix.
May 26, 1959, in Milwaukee on the Mound, Harvey Haddix of the Pirates was mowing them down. 27 up, 27 gone, 9 innings in the book, and not a man had gotten on. Now in history, only 17 have thrown a perfect game. A most exclusive club and a most exalted fame. But after 9, the Pirates, well, they hadn't scored a perfect game, and still Harvey had to pitch some.
This past Saturday, I had a chance to speak with Irish singer-songwriter James Vincent McMorrow, who is playing as part of Dynalone Records' 10th anniversary Cross Canada tour. I spoke with him about playing as part of this event, as well as I spoke to him about his new album, Post Tropical. James Vincent McMorrow, hello.
Hello.
So tell us a little bit about this event. How does it feel playing in what is essentially the middle of the street?
Yeah, for anybody that hasn't seen it, describing it like that is like a little, it's a little more elaborate than that, isn't it? But in principle, it's strange. I mean, it's strange because like all of these people on the right hand side eating dinner, and then like 3,000 or 4,000 people all kind of standing around, is kind of slightly odd, but actually really great. And this bus is like really tricked out, so like it wasn't like me standing there with an amp. This thing is like properly powerful, so I thought it was really good. I was amazed at the crowd and how into it they were, because I just kind of thought it would be like a Red Bull thing where like loads of people just come because it's free and it's out. But it was like my show. It felt like everyone was there to see me, which was really nice.
Do you find it a slightly different vibe than when you're doing like an indoor club show?
Oh yeah, I mean, I was a little jumpy. It's a totally different animal. Like, because this wasn't quite it's not a festival slot, but it, for all intents and purposes, this is a festival show because it's outdoors and there's not like big sound checks, and it's always going to be a little creaky and a little kind of strange in places for me. It's not going to be as slick. I like shows when they are not slick. That sounds really kind of lame, but when they flow. That's exactly what I'm trying to say. I love when a show flows, and this was a little clunky for me, and I haven't played in a while, so yeah, it's a very different animal. My own shows are completely different to this.
So your second album, Post Tropical, came out last year, and this was more soulful than your first album. What was your decision to move from the folk to into the more soul aspect of music?
I think I probably don't see it that way. So I didn't really think about it. Like, I don't necessarily see the things as, like, I play an acoustic guitar. I couldn't know less about folk music if I tried. Like, I just, it's not my, I don't consider it folk music. I considered it like singer-songwriter with an acoustic guitar. The second record, I had a little, you know, there was just more opportunity to explore more things. And I think the job of a musician, first and foremost, is to explore. So, I think I made a first record that was very much framed around the acoustic guitar, but if you listen to it, like, I played We Don't Eat, which is off the first record, there with acoustic guitar tonight, so you would frame it as like, I guess, a folk song in that context. But if you listen to it on the album, there's no guitar, it's pianos and drums, that's it, and it couldn't sound less like a folk song. So it depends what the interpretation of those types of music is, and that's something that intrigues me. Like folk music is about sensibility to me, it's about lyrics and stuff, and from a lyrical standpoint, I've always been a soul musician. Like, I sing from a first perspective. I sing about, it's emotional music, which to me is soul music. Whereas folk music was protest music. It was music of protest. It's a different thing. So, it's about, you know, all of those things. About pushing yourself, and it's about being in a different position than you are from album to album. I would never repeat it. The first album was very successful, but it was successful in an organic way and as part of a process. This is part of the process. The third album, again, it seems to be coming somewhere between the two of them in terms of the songwriting and the production. That's how it should be. I'm not here to just repeat myself or to just bore myself. Like, I want to make beautiful records that push boundaries, if that's possible, in whatever way it is.
Why do musicians and artists have a duty for themselves to constantly reinvent their artist selves?
I can only answer from my perspective. I think that the music business is a very complicated thing. It always has been. And your experience in the music business, I think, actually frames a lot of what you do. I put out my first record because nobody gave me a chance. No, like, I wasn't ready for the chance, to be fair. I'm not blaming anybody, but ultimately no one gave me a chance and said, we're going to pay for you to make a record, let's take a chance on this. So I went and made it by myself. It was very limited and very like, and a reflection of my experience at that point. And then the second record is much more, you know, everyone embracing what I do a lot more, and you want to, you feel like, okay, my experience in this has showed me that I'm good at this. I know what I'm doing. I can sing the songs. I can write the songs that I want to write. Maybe I'll push it a little bit more and see what else is possible. And also the labels that I was with gave me more money and different things. Not a huge amount more money, but still more. And there was more ambition as well. And ambition is a huge part of it. And, you know, there's a reason why, you know, if you asked any musician, like, let's take the nth example, someone like Paul Simon, like someone that made beautiful songs, like, you know, in Simon and Garfunkel, and when he was 45 he made his best record and he made his best work at that point, like 25 years more into his career. And if you ask him now what his favorite songs are, he's not going to tell you Bridge Over Troubled Water. He's going to tell you Songs of Grace, and he's going to tell you like Obvious Child, these beautiful important songs. So even Paul Simon, who could have just dialed it in and written those songs forever, you know, progressed and changed and pushed himself into new things. And every musician that I love does that. I've never listened to a band or listened to an artist that doesn't absolutely push whatever is possible for them within this business.
You mentioned earlier some songs have piano, some songs have guitar. Do you know when you're writing the song which instrument it's going to fit with? How organic is that process?
At this point, it's very much based on the songs you've written out of productions. So I don't sit with it. On the second album, for sure, anyway. Like, this third album is a little bit more writing with a piano or writing with a guitar or something like that. But there's no... With the second record, it was like I had these little ideas on my laptop and I was singing over them, and so they were what they were to a certain extent. Like, piano was in the production, so it's piano was the instrument I played, or guitar was in the production, guitar was the instrument I played. And like, certain songs have certain feels. Like, I mean, the last song I played there, Cavalier, it needed a Fender Rhodes, it needed that wash, and it didn't, like, the sharpness of a piano wouldn't work. Their production decisions is more than anything. Acoustic guitar is a very specific sound, it only works with certain melodies and certain cadences, it won't work. Whereas washy sounds like Rhodes and synthesizers and things, for me as a songwriter, they give me way more opportunity to flex my muscles as a singer, I guess, which is why I tend to gravitate towards them. People listen to those sounds and they think, oh, you're emulating this or that. It's not about that. It's about, like, it's about how I'm comfortable singing and what gives me the best opportunity to really, like, push it.
Yeah.
So it's always singing decisions and it's always production decisions in tandem.
The Irish, at least over here, are known for their use of language and their use of words. How much of your Irish identity would you say is ingrained in your songwriting?
A lot of it. Just inherent in it, and just like in its DNA. Like, I don't. I guess the way I sing is soul music, but there's a lilt to it that's Irish, because there's a very specific, like, lilt to Irish voices. And I mean, from a musical standpoint, being perfectly honest, I grew up listening to a lot of Irish music. I talked on stage there about U2 and my experience growing up listening to things like Achtung Baby, especially Achtung Baby, and the Joshua Tree, more so when I was like a little older going back to it. They're probably the only band that really kind of like gave me like a feel. Like, I remember listening to The Fly when I was like, oh yeah, I don't know how old I was, like maybe like 6 or 7, and I had like, I remember listening to music, probably, it feels like it was younger than a lot of other people were listening to, but that's maybe me just imagining that, it could not be true. But I do distinctly remember listening to that record and it just being like a really like eye-opening thing. Not that I wanted to emulate that musically, but that you're like, wow, Irish people can make amazing shit. Like, this is so dope and so huge. I have a really, really heightened sense of Irish pride, and I think most Irish artists in the world have that. Like, I think that no matter who you are, it's cool to see Irish music and Irish art traveling in the world, because we're a small country and there's no, like, we don't have divine right to artistry. We just seem to do really well with it. And that informs how I go as well, because it, from an ambition standpoint. So not musically, I wasn't like sitting down listening to like, you know, Damien Rice records thinking, oh my God, I want to make this. But at the same time, when I was in college, Damien Rice was like smashing it. He had the biggest album in that world, And everybody was talking about him, and it just gave everybody a sense of, this is possible. This is, like, he's this guy that we saw playing on the street a year ago, and now he's selling 2 million albums on his own terms. It's like, there's no... I would defy to find any other country in the world where that exists, like, for such a small population to have so many big hitters in that level. That gave me real ambition, it gave me real fire to be like, I can do that, why can't we all do that? That's amazing. And so that's what Irish music means to me, more than on a musical level, just on a, this is incredible, I can't believe we have this opportunity, like, it's amazing.
Well, James Vincent McGuire, thank you so much.
My pleasure, man.
Well, that was James Vincent McMorrow, and this is Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, CJSF.ca, and this is the song Gold by James Vincent McMorrow off his album Post Tropical. James Vincent McMorrow. My next guest has worked as a butler and majordomo for 25 years, and in 2009 founded the only butler and household management school in North America. He is Charles Montgomery, and I had a chance, Charles McPherson, and I had a chance to speak with him last week. Charles McPherson, thanks so much for joining me today.
It's great to be with you.
So, my first question is how does one decide they want to be a butler for a living?
Oh my goodness, what a great question. You know, a butler is someone who really wants to be of service and to help facilitate someone's life. But the movies have taught us that butlers are in service. service and kind of live in and have no life. But the modern butler of today, who's in service, as in anyone, for example, in the hospitality industry, is you go home at night and you have your own life. So it's really, you know, if you have a love of service and hospitality, it's a great marriage.
Talk about that a little bit, because when we see movies that feature, you know, the elite or the upper class, the butler is often portrayed as sort of a, you know, a somewhat stuffy black coat type of person. How inaccurate is this portrayal from the real life modern day butler?
So, you know, if we want to look at the butler 150 years ago, the butler was a very stiff, rigid person, because we were back in the Victorian era when etiquette was at the stiffest point that it ever was. And so there was rules for everything. And so the butler followed in society based on the way society was at the time. But in the modern world, in, you know, today, the butler is much more informal, which doesn't mean less professional, but doesn't have the rigidity of the rules of the past.
So, you know, one of the things that I noticed for here is that it's not only, you know, about serving, but it's also about, you know, etiquette and entertainment and hosting. And I'm curious as to how sort of the economic changes in the last, you know, 5-10 years or so have changed not only the butlering aspect of it, but also the hosting aspect of it.
Well, what's interesting is that there is a greater demand for butlers today than there has been in the last 50-60 years. And that's really, you know, happened because as the economy has changed and, you know, as wealth has kind of come back into our economy, there is a demand for people who are able to afford and have multiple homes, that the butler is someone who can really make you have a better life.
And my other question is about, we see a lot of this time about you, and I like what you talk about in your book about, you know, the proper way to do these things and the proper way to etiquette. And I remember, you know, when I was in high school, I took foods, but it was just about the food. It wasn't about how to serve it at all, per se.
Yep.
Do you think that that's something that we should teach kids in high school, is about etiquette and sort of the hospitality side of things?
I totally believe in that. And, you know, I think sometimes etiquette is misunderstood as something that's just for rich people or for snobby people. But etiquette is actually, how do we interact amongst ourselves every day? How do you deal with your family at the breakfast table? How do you talk to the on the way to work? How do you deal with someone, you know, in a cubicle beside you at work? And so etiquette is about socially interacting. And so what I love about, you know, etiquette, and that's one of the reasons I wrote my book, you know, The Pocket Butler, is that I think etiquette gives you self-confidence. If you know how to shake someone's hand properly, how do you make an introduction correctly? When you're at the table having dinner with a client or your boss talking about a promotion or trying to get a job, knowing which fork and which knife to use, how do I put my napkin on my lap, how do I order in a restaurant, all those kinds of things are not foolish, but it's about giving yourself confidence, because if you know how to do something, then you relax with other people, and that self-confidence attracts others to you.
On that note, it seems that in today's society, people are less and less personable and just communicating with each other less because of, you know, technology. People are always on their phones. They're always in a rush. How do you find that technology has affected the etiquette industry?
So what's interesting is that we all thought that technology would be a great way to increase communication amongst all of us. But what I think has happened from an etiquette perspective and technology is that we're becoming farther apart because of the technology. And so when we're actually with someone, we're almost uncomfortable, because now we, you know, we aren't used to having to talk to someone. We're used to sending them an email or a text. So how do I actually speak to someone? Because, you know, when you're doing an email, the only thing that comes through is the words that you type. When I'm with you in person, it's the tone of my voice, it's my body language, and the words that are combined. And I think that's what is being hurt by technology.
Another point you make in your book is you talk about when hosting, you should read or aim to read a newspaper or watch the news channel every day so you can talk about events. But at least with newspapers, they're becoming a little bit obsolete, and I find that news is sort of whatever you find yourself interested in. So how can we create that balance between an important subject to talk about and what interests us?
So I think that the newspaper is a delivery method of what's going on around the world. So whether the newspaper is something that you read, whether you read a blog, whether you listen to the radio, whether you watch something, on a clip on the video, I don't think any of that matters. What I think the point that I'm hoping to make is that I want people to not be afraid to explore what's going on in the world, because then when you and I sit down and we have a beer at a bar together after work, or when we're going to have lunch, or when we're having dinner with, maybe your future mother-in-law or a boss, you have something to talk about. And if someone all of a sudden starts to talk about a topic in the world, you don't have to be an expert on it, but you need to at least be aware of what's going on around the world. That makes you an interesting person to be with. And that was kind of my whole thing about whether you're a host or your guest reading the newspaper. And like I said, it's the delivery method, so it doesn't matter what delivery method you're using, but you become a more interesting person and people want to be with you when you have a knowledge, or at least an understanding of what's going on around you.
Is there a difference for you between the formality and the structure of things and tradition?
Fabulous question. I think they're actually different. I think formality can be uncomfortable at times, but tradition is something as a ritual that you do that you particularly like. And a ritual doesn't have to be formal. A ritual can be something very casual. So I love rituals, but I also love certain formalities when something's important. When someone gets married, for example, there's certain traditions that you do and certain formalities that we do that are still fun.
You talk a lot in the book about the differences between the West culture and Asia and Africa, and how in many ways they're opposite to each other. Talk a little bit about the differences in them, and during a party, if there's cross-cultural, whether the onus is on the host or the guest to adapt to said culture.
So, as the world is becoming, much smaller, if you will, because of, how it's such a global world, we have all of our different cultures that are starting to collide. And so, whether you're a host or a guest, if you at least are aware of other cultures, then you know how to be comfortable with that person and make the other person comfortable. So, for example, in certain cultures, there isn't cross-gender touching. So, for example, if I was in the Middle East and I was, whether it was social or on business, and I went to shake a woman's hand, that becomes a problem because it makes them uncomfortable. And then when they become uncomfortable, I become uncomfortable. So I think what's important is that whether you're traveling or whether you're entertaining, to be aware of other cultures, that it's no longer just where we live, but we need to be aware of others.
Another thing that you talk about that is maybe misunderstood in a way is the type of dress and attire for different occasions. Talk a little bit about that.
So what's fascinating is that, we've always, known for the last, 15, 20 years about casual Fridays. What's fascinating is that companies are now starting to say casual Friday is no longer acceptable because people took that as going too far. Casual Friday was technically you just didn't wear a tie that day. But what it's become is cut-off jeans and a tank top. And that's not something that a lawyer, for example, can wear, or a banker. It makes people uncomfortable when you're going to see a professional and they're there in a tank top and a pair of jeans. We're not at the beach. And so, it's okay that the world has changed. We don't necessarily need to wear a shirt and tie everywhere, but I think what's important is that we need to be aware of where we are. So, for example, if you're going to court, you need to dress appropriately for that place. If you're going to a wedding, you don't go in a bathing suit, but if you're going to the beach, you also don't go in a suit. So I think what we need to do is stop trying to say that I can wear whatever I want wherever I go, but just try to be cognizant of the environment that you're going into and making sure that you dress appropriately for that environment.
I'm curious as to your thoughts on how certain etiquette rules can be transposed in other ways. Like, for example, in schools, many schools, both in Canada and the U.S., are implementing dress codes that many feel are inappropriate because they sort of demean or they seem to be further limiting what one gender can wear over the other. What are your thoughts on that?
So I guess from an etiquette perspective, you know, are we in school because it's where we want to be able to show our individuality, or are we in school because we're there to learn? And so that becomes, you know, I think a really healthy debate for society. And I think that it's good for us to be able to have those conversations. You know, there was a time when you would wear a uniform to school, and people said, oh, no, that's not fair. You know, you should be allowed to wear what you want. And then that kind of stuff. But now some schools, for example, are going back to a uniform specifically because then it doesn't show whether you're rich or poor because everyone just kind of wears the same thing and you're all at the school to be able to learn. So I think that, you know, I think that what's healthy about etiquette is that etiquette shouldn't be something that's static, but it should be something that I would refer to as like a living, breathing document that changes with our society as society changes. The rules of 1860 don't apply today, but because etiquette is about how do we interact with each other to make each other feel comfortable, so how can we apply some common rules that makes everyone comfortable today?
We were earlier talking about the portrayals of butlers in media. Recently there was Lee Daniels, the butler, and of course famously there's Downton Abbey. How would you say those two portrayals are compared to your life, per se?
You know what? They're fabulous characters. You know, Mr. Carson in Downton Abbey is perfect for the era in which that particular program is filmed. You know, but the reality is Mr. Carson today is a much less formal person because our society is less formal. But what I say about Downton Abbey, because I'm addicted to it, I think it's a great program, as accurate as it is, it's still a soap opera. It's not always perfect. And that's okay. But it's still, I think it's interesting to be able to look at the past and see what we can bring to where we are today in the future. But when I look at, for example, Lee Daniels in The Butler, that's also such a great movie because, you know, butlers in the White House have come a long way from when it first started and slavery to today where it's a sought-after profession. I mean, as a butler, imagine being able to meet world leaders around the world. You know, where else would you ever have that opportunity but to be in a role of a butler?
You delve a little bit into food pairings. And of course, there's always the, you know, what wine goes with what. So, how did you learn how to cultivate the proper pairings in that regard?
So, as a butler, I had to be able to deal and manage the wine cellar. So, my employer, he taught me a lot about wine. But the most important lesson that he taught me, because when I was ignorant about wine, I thought to myself, ooh, you have to have only red with meat and white with fish, and it can only be a certain kind of wine with a certain product. So is it going to be a Bordeaux, or is it going to be a Beaujolais, or is it going to be a Cabernet? And so I used to think that there had to be these very rigid rules, and that's kind of was my ignorance. What I learned from my employer was that drink what you like with what you're eating. And I thought that was such a simplistic way to put it. And so in the book, there's some guidelines to get you started. But if you happen to like white wine with steak, then you should have white wine with steak. I don't think that you should feel obligated to stay to very rigid rules of the past.
And sort of two patterns that I've noticed both in reading your book and just sort of learning about food culture is that when it comes to classic style, there sort of seems to be two traditions, the French and the Italian. Why are those two food cultures, why have they survived throughout the ages in our day and age?
I think that the reason that those particular cultures have survived is because the foods are based on classic techniques that never fail. So, for example, if you're going to make a sauce blanche, so it's a white sauce, you're going to need a roux, which is equal parts of butter and flour. And then you're going to add a hot milk or cream to that to start to make your sauce. So I think the point that I want to make is that the cooking of those countries is based on very classic techniques that when you learn how to make a basic sauce with flour, butter, and milk, then you can add cheese to it so it becomes a Mornay sauce or other things. And so that's why I think they survive, is because they're built on solid techniques versus one-ofs.
And finally, why is a red wine glass typically bigger than a white wine glass?
Do you know what? That's a really good question. And I don't think I know the correct answer to that question. My guess would be, I think the red wine glass is bigger because we want the red wine traditionally to breathe more than the white, and it kind of sits there for a longer period of time to breathe, and so the wider bowl of the glass allows the wine to breathe. But I have to be honest, I don't know if that's the exact technical reason.
Well, the book is The Pocket Butler, A Compact Guide to Modern Manners, Business Etiquette, and Everyday Entertaining. Charles McPherson, thank you so much for your time today.
It's always a pleasure. Be well.
All right. Cheers. Have a good day.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Before the break there, you heard Charles McPherson. His book is The Pocket Butler. My thanks to Charles. My thanks to James Vincent McMorrow. And, of course, my thanks to Greg Proops. This has been Endeavors on CJSF. In honor of B.B. King, we are going to take you out with the B.B. King song, Every Day I Have the Blues. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye. Thinking of worries and troubles, love.